are listening to the INCJ podcast, Conversations about International Criminal Justice.
Hello, welcome to an INCJ podcast with me, Rob Watson. And today I'm going to be talking with Emma Short, who I will get to introduce herself in a second. This is in anticipation, loosely in anticipation of a webinar that we're putting on next week with the Probation Institute about digital rehabilitation. And Emma's work is related to this field, but not directly part of that, but we thought it would be a good idea to have a conversation about Emma's work. Do you want to introduce yourself, Emma, and just kind of give us a brief headline tour of what you do and how you got to where you do what you do?
Well, I'm a professor of cyber psychology, and my research, I teach cyber psychology, which I love because the students I work with bring in new things every week, because they are engaged on platforms I'm not. So I kind of feel as if I'm continually having a conversation about what's happening and its evolution. But my research is largely around cyber stalking or tech-facilitated intrusion. And I've been working in that field for about 20 years. And the changes I have seen are enormous. Imagine the internet in 2006. It was a very, very different place. So that's really where I am.
I like that phrase, tech-supported intrusion. Was that the phrase? Yeah.
Yeah, tech-facilitated intrusion and surveillance.
Right. So let's just map this out a little bit so that we get a sense of what it is and what the distinctions and differences are between these. So how would you define what cyber is? And we'll come back to what the stalking element is in a minute. How would you define what the tech element of this is? And then we'll look at the intrusion and the stalking part of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, all the terms are still very moot, like in any early emerging field. Some people prefer the phrase tech facilitated stalking. Some people prefer cyber stalking. You know, there's really variation in the way we're describing this. But tech facilitated basically means a course of conduct in the case of stalking that is partially enabled through technology. So the course of conduct, would fit sort of criminal justice definitions of what stalking is, say sort of pursuing someone, intruding in an unwanted way, seeking proximity, that sort of thing. But the tech allows us to do it more easily with less friction, i.e. you can very easily see just by looking at someone's Instagram page, is their regular post at what they're up to. Things like location enabled platforms, apps like Find My Phone and so on, enable you to follow that person. You don't have to follow them along the street anymore because you can see them on the street on your phone.
The point of social media was that we were able to observe each other, and for whatever motivations we have for that is benign or malicious. So let's think this through in terms of when does something shift from that benign purience, often, just gossip and social nature of, kind of looking at what, looking out your windows to see what your neighbours are up to something which is a little bit more or less benign, shall we say?
I think this is a really good question, because there's what's benign, what's not benign and what's criminal. And you've got this sort of sliding scale involved. My feeling, and I've thought about this a great deal, is that if you're just noticing someone online and what they're up to, that's fine. That's natural curiosity. It's what we do in life. But when you shift from that to kind of assigning meaning or attempting to control, or intrude in an unwanted way in people's lives, you crossed a boundary. And I think in a lot of ways, tech enables us to become more invested in people online than we would otherwise. You get the prompts to have a look at people's email accounts, you get alerts, you get notifications, and we're tuning into people who are quite remotely connected to us in a way that we never did before. So I think there is a real enabling that's happening generally. It becomes criminal when you are clearly pursuing communicating and messaging people in a way that is unwanted. And in UK law, it sort of cranks up to stalking when that also becomes associated with creating fear and distress and disrupts everyday life for that person, i.e. they are making changes to their day-to-day in order to feel safe and be safe.
The first thing that comes to mind, and this might not be a very well thought through thing, but some people are exhibitionists and love to have everything, you know, on display and out there. They're very extroverted and gregarious, and other people might not be so. You know, is it relative to the person's disposition that something might be considered? Because in both ways, you know, you think about in terms of bullying, often we internalize something which would otherwise externally be regarded as bullying or overtly controlling behavior, but some people don't even notice that's going on or that's part of it, and then you have that thing of, well, you're just being too sensitive, you're just being, you know, you're too shy, you know, this is how the world works kind of thing. How do we look at this and say, well, actually this is where this set of behaviors collides with this set of needs of an individual to either protect themselves or to engage with the world. What's your experience, and is there a framework for that we can look at?
This is fascinating because it's something I've encountered and I've watched unfold over many years. You know, right at the beginning, reactions to people who would report to the police, perhaps, that they felt they were being stalked online, you know, quite often would be, well, you know, take that stuff down or don't put it online. You know, don't be a participant in this environment, you know, which really was victim blaming. It was kind of saying your demonstration of your presence in the world in this online environment has created this kind of offence, you know, and we are moving very strongly away from that. Everyone is a player now. Everyone is on platforms, and to be social and also to be active in the workspace, say on LinkedIn and so on, you need to put yourself out there. It's often not just social networks. It's about income generation. People need visibility because that's the way the world works now. To be visible online is to be seen as active and engaged. So for many of us, I don't feel we have a choice about whether or not we put stuff on there. So I think in a way that's a side issue. In the early days, people who had more connections, it seemed to be that they were more likely to get perceived online than people who had less connections and were less active. But generally, stalking and that kind of pursuit after relationships isn't really related to how active you are online. It's related to the context of the relationship breakdown. However you are operating online is likely to be exploited or violated by the person who is stalking you.
We've seen some quite high profile cases, and it's an ongoing lively debate in the UK about freedom of speech, where members of the public have had what has been described as the thought police turning up, you know, five or six police officers, because somebody puts out a tweet, and the police, there was a case recently where, you know, somebody was saying, well, you're reading books about Brexit, therefore is this just subjective? Or is there an objective way of accounting for, one, the kind of motivations of the people involved, but two, the way in which we account for it more generally?
That's interesting. I mean, really, you're talking about sort of trolling or harassment or hate crime, you know, hate speech, where people are tweeting at people or about people. And that's kind of slightly different from cyber stalking. And it's a central debate as well, free speech versus protection and public safety. Because, say, a tweet that incites perhaps action and violence is dangerous to the general public. You know, and we've seen so much speculation around rioting, for example, and how much of that was fueled by social media and narratives that inflamed hateful speech and attitudes and got people out on the street. You're right. The free speech versus public safety issue is a very real tension.
Yeah, it's just trying to pull apart the separate issues so we know what we're looking at. And yeah. So how would you summarise then the difference about cyber stalking within that kind of context of looking at these other broader range of set of issues? What is there specifically that we is important that we look at this issue on its own terms?
Okay, I mean, so cyber stalking, if we're assuming cyber stalking is stalking, and I would say they are, you can't separate them anymore. It's a fixation on one individual by another person where they are trying to either create a higher level of intimacy, i.e. get close to them, maybe exact revenge on them for a sense of grievance that they have, or pursue a relationship that's never happened. Those are generally the kind of reasons it happens. But it's a very interpersonal thing between, well, from one individual targeted at another. So it's not random tweets or harassment or nasty messaging. It is a real attempt at engagement and in violation of those accounts in an attempt to intrude upon another person.
How do the... In your, let's talk about your research and how this is borne out in evidence. First of all, the question that comes to mind is all of the social media platforms have different ways of dealing with this, and they've to some extent disengaged from some of the high level moderation that used to be in place, and they've reduced the levels of moderation. What's going on with those platforms, and how is it, if you're getting stalked by somebody on X or Instagram, is it worth making a complaint to those platforms about, or do you have to deal with it in other ways?
Well, in terms of terms and conditions and all of that, it should be possible to make a complaint and it be dealt with. But feedback is that it's very variable, the response you get, if you even get a response. I think we have to engage in shared accountability here. Online spaces are ones that public services did not create and cannot control. So to have access to things like accounts or any powers to remove that person, quite often, the police have to make applications to those platforms for release of information, and they may or may not give it. And the police may or may not be skilled in writing those applications so they're successful. So there are so many barriers, but crimes online, sort of whether they're threats or whatever, remain crimes. So the police can act to close the space for action of that perpetrator. They can make arrests on that basis, or charges at least. So the platform response is very variable, and it really, it's time that we've started being noisier about that and insisting on better, I think, if we're going to kind of move forward. But they remain crimes, and they are visible evidence if the evidence is captured.
What's the way then that the police are generally trained and set up? Because, this has been going on for a long time. I think one of the things about the Online Harms Bill Act, I can't remember the exact name of it, but that's what it is. And it's like, this has been going on since the inception of the internet. And, it's like, it's just, and people have an element of it is kind of, well, that's just the internet. You kind of have to kind of get used to it. This is the environment. What do you expect kind of thing? It's like, you've got a local pub down the road and it's a rowdy pub and it always has been. Just don't visit there kind of attitude. But how are the police then how do they look at this systematically to kind of, as you say, recognize, make that distinction between something which is socially, something might be offensive, but that's not being offensive is not a crime. Something might be pressuring, but that might not be a crime. But when do they take it into systems and processes and framework has the police got that then pushes that into the criminal domain, the act, and it would be processed through the courts on that basis?
You'd have to speak to a police officer about that. But, from my perspective, I've spoken to advocates, some police and survivors of stalking. And again, it's variable. nearly all police know, following inquiries and things, that there needs to be more systematic, nationally recognised training on how to collect digital evidence, what standards it should reach, and what protocols they need to go through it. And some forces are very, very good at it. But there are 43 forces in the UK, and a lot of variability between them. I think there's much more consistency now on what is acceptable as evidence. And there's much more understanding that a lot of digital evidence, while it gives you a much better digital footprint than actual physical evidence does, you know, sightings of people who may or may not have been following you, if you do capture someone's course of conduct online, it's unequivocal, isn't it? It's there. But it can also be temporary. You know, people can delete accounts, they can remove evidence. And unless their devices are seized and forensically examined, you can't uncover the full footprint if they've been agile and they've been moving things around. But to get license to confiscate people's devices, you know, you have to get quite far down the line. You know, a charge has to be raised. So yeah, you're quite far down the line already before you can actually kind of withdraw those devices.
So there typically might be other flags, if you like, you know, real world flags, which then when they're cross-referenced with online behaviour. So often I'm just trying to imagine a scenario, which is that if somebody is accused of cyber stalking or online stalking, that there's actually a pattern of behavior in reality as well, and that other people might have observed that and made complaints about it to the police or made reports on behalf of that other person.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the experience of, you know, the victim as well, you know, they will have known they are becoming alarmed and distressed and there is a real worrying pursuit happening, but they'll likely be quite unaware of all of the online activity that's been happening because things like surveillance and so on and searches online won't be visible to them. They'll only be on the devices of the person who is enacting this course of conduct.
Because there's a phrase, I can't remember, what is it off the top of my head? I can't remember the phrase. It's about when somebody's acting under duress or somebody's manipulative behaviour. And there's a phrase that the police use, which is, it's like controlling behaviour or something like that. I can't remember exactly the term. But it's like that then is observed by other people. And then when the police come in and examine that person's phone, for example, the victim who doesn't often see themselves as being the victim, the police examine the phone. Oh no, this is the pattern. This is what the control and behavior is, and this is what it amounts to.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting you say that. It's sort of coercive control, you know, and stalking have got a lot of things in common. You know, the attempts to control, restrict, manipulate the person they're targeting on, you know, are quite similar. You know, only stalking tends to be identified when it's post-relationship, when that person is now outside of the relationship. But those attempts to control, intrude, manipulate remain.
Yeah. It was interesting that I thought it was really fascinating that I said, you'll have to ask a police officer. Because, and then you said, you know, because there isn't a consistent, and that's, why do you think we've not got a kind of consistent framework for this? Has this just been left for individual forces to kind of just pick up as they see fit, or, you know, is it a lack of leadership? What is it, a lack of academic evidence base for, you know, looking at this? Why do you think that might be, that it's so fragmented?
All of those things are true. I think all of those things are true. And I think, you know, there's so much skilled cyber in police, you know, for things like fraud, terrorism. There is so much good practice in units that could be shared into, say, the VORC sector, the violence against women and girls sector, and, you know, stalking crimes, because the capability is there for other crimes. You know, that sort of forensic investigation, the understanding of patterns of online behaviour. And I sometimes think if the skills learned in those crime areas could be shared much more freely with other areas, like the ones we're talking about, you know, I think we could move faster, further. Yeah, further ahead, more quickly.
And do you have much contact with people in, you know, jurisdictions around the world? Is there stuff that we can learn from other countries about this? Is that part of your research to look at and work with other people?
I'm afraid I'm very UK-centric, but I'm very, very open to conversations for anyone who might be listening.
What might those conversations, what would you like those conversations to consist of?
I'd like to know what works and if anything does work, and if there are any obvious solutions that we are ignoring or we are not resourced to do at the moment, because I, you know, raising our voices to improve the situation is going to have value. If we know what's needed that isn't there, let's ask for it loudly and consistently.
I'm going to ask you a question. There's two main questions that I just want to kind of draw this to a close, if you like, because this is our quick fire one. We'll hopefully get back together at some point and do a more extended discussion at a round table. But I was going to say one of the other, I mean, there's an opposite to stalking, which is ghosting, which is very, very common, because it's like a kind of passive aggressive approach that organizations, rather than, you know, exclusion can be, as you know, you can be a victim of ghosting and exclusion as much as you can be targeted by a particular individual and stalked. Is there any connection between the two? Is that something that is, you know, I mean, usually it's civil cases where things like, you know, ghosting and you know, usually it's in an employment tribunal situation that there's evidence that somebody was treated in that way, that's when it's done through that way. But is there a crossover with kind of, you know, that?
It does emerge. I mean, there is quite a lot of literature out there, a little bit anyway, about ghosting after intimate relationships. And there's also growing understanding in sort of some very recently published work about the fact that that seems to be par for the course, that it seems to be part of modern dating, that ghosting is something that happens. But it causes enormous distress. But somehow it seems to be one of those things that is becoming normalized, that you just cut off, you block, you walk away, which is not how things have happened in the past, you know, and the social norms for it aren't established, you know, about the sympathy you might receive or the empathy that people might feel for you when that's happened. You're very much on your own with this pain and this sense of confusion, with no explanation about what happened.
The follow-on for this is about the psychological model or models that might help us to understand this. Now, I'm an INFJ, which is on the Myers-Briggs thing, and one of the characteristics of the INFJ is called the door slam, where you do exactly what you just described. You cut people off. And it's like, and when I first read about this, it's like, oh my God, I've done this all the way through. You know, you get into a situation, you get into a relationship, and somebody, for want of a better phrase, pisses you off, and it's like the door gets slammed and they are left in a situation, but you know, I just move on. And it's like, and that's a normal pattern of behavior, not just online but you know, kind of in the real world. And it's like you see that and you go, oh gosh, I didn't know that was an objective thing. But it suggests, you know, I'm not saying my experience is suggestive of very much, but there are, if we look at different models and patterns of behavior, what's your focus, and what do you think drives this as a psychological phenomena that maybe takes somebody from what would be that, go back to that question about benign, and take somebody into the malicious component, you know, dimension of this?
That makes me want to go away and write 5,000 words. There is so you could respond to with that. I'm thinking about sort of online space, and I'm also thinking about some of the sort of 1970s work on relationship breaking emotional bonds. But there's so much in between. The online space, I think, you know, from what I know about identity formation in the online space, many people are curating their personas online. You know, this is who I am, this is what I'm doing. And when something changes in their lives that no longer fits with that, there is a need to curate or shut down the thing that no longer fits. So there's kind of an imperative, if you are driven in terms of curating your identity online, there feels like an imperative, I think, sometimes to tidy it up quickly, to remove the thing that no longer fits. And I think to some extent that can explain some ghosting behavior. At the other end, it's sort of connected. Steve Duck did a lot of work years and years ago, and I still think his work was fabulous. And he talked about the dissolution of relationships as the final stage being what he called grave dressing, which is where you tell your story and you present the ending that works best for you. And that may just be ghosting, i.e. it never happened, or it may be putting up a dialogue of your story, your narrative, your perspective. So that's what's seen and that's what's presented. And social media posts give us so much more opportunity to do that than we've ever had, to tell the story of your, maybe your sadness or your confusion, or your righteous kind of position where you've ended something that was wrong and damaging to you. And I really wish we could revisit that model, his explanation of the making and breaking of emotional bonds, bring it into the digital estate. That is a paper I would love to write.
Well, that sounds fascinating, because I think there's a tendency, you know, we've projected and at incredible speed put in a new form of globalized communication for which we are ill prepared, both you know, mentally and psychologically. As you know, if there's a difference between those two things, but you know, we put this in place, and we're just not up, you know, we just don't have the skills to understand. So it's almost as if the, you know, you can understand the perpetrator. And, you know, I think one of the mistakes maybe with this is to envisage that the perpetrator is somehow uniquely cruel and what's the word I'm looking for? You know, willful about their act, which actually they might be the victim of something themselves, because they're ill-equipped to deal with the context and the situation. I mean, again, that's for the courts and juries and all the civic, you know, the judicial process to evaluate. And we've got, you know, fortunately, in you know, we've got 1,000 years of history of, you know, common law to draw on for these kind of things, whereas the whole kind of dropping this into the virtual domain, the digital domain, it isn't actually new. So it's, we're drawing on things which, you know, human nature doesn't change that quickly.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. And I think if we take the sort of perpetrators of harm out of it, you know, who are willfully inflicting a course of conduct, and we think about our general population, we are really ill prepared. We were not designed to envisage the audiences that our communications reach. We're used to talking to small groups of close friends or sort of wider groups within our community. But most of us, when we are online and we are engaging in line and we're emotionally disclosing, we are not thinking that there has been a full context collapse, that actually anyone can see this, it can be retweeted, it can be recirculated, and our very private experiences are actually being broadcast worldwide, you know, if we're unfortunate enough and they get amplified to that degree. And none of us, I think, approach any post we make with that in mind. So yeah, you know, we cannot envisage how our communication lands, because that's not how we were designed.
Mm. Okay, there's a lot of papers and a lot of thought yes. to be done with this. So we shall reconvene at some point soon, I hope, and we'll have a broader conversation and bring some colleagues in who have different international experiences. I think that will be our aim for this. So is there a way that people can find more out about you and your work? Where's the best place for people to visit online?
I mean, I would say have a look on LinkedIn. I've probably got my profiles sort of linked up to that. There's some papers that have been published if you hop on Google Scholar. But I'm always open to conversations. This is something, you know, I understand a little bit of, but you know, and having worked at it for 20 years, I still feel I only understand a little bit of it. And I'm very open to conversations and sort of development of that thinking and understanding.
Okay, well, I'll add notes. Emma, thank you very much. It's been fascinating. And we will follow this up with further conversations, I think.
Thanks for your time, Mark.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the INCJ podcast, Conversations about International Criminal Justice. To find out more, go to our website at criminaljusticenetwork.net or follow us on Twitter at INTCJ Network.